This is Chris Albert, and I'm here to remind you of one thing. Someday, you're going to die. Now, that's not some morbid statement or scary idea. It's solid fact. Your time here on this earth is limited. And you need to be reminded of this as much as possible for one simple reason. To live your best life while you can. This is the Warrior Soul Podcast.
You know, on your journey through life, you're going to often encounter situations that are going to be pretty difficult. There's going to be a lot of times where you're going to feel like you want to pull your hair out of your head and you're going to feel like you're spinning your wheels, going nowhere. But each and every single time you run into one of these difficulties, you got to understand something. It's preparing you. It's making you stronger. And it's teaching you a lesson that you'll be able to use at some point in the future. You never know what's going to happen in your life. The only way to get better is when you encounter one of these difficult situations, to not give up. And then once you get through it, to not be bitter about it, not be angry about it, but to allow it to teach you a lesson so that when you encounter your next difficult situation, when you encounter your next challenge, you're better able to handle it. On today's podcast, we have actor Kazi Toganas. He's been in John Wick, and most recently, he was a supporting actor in The Equalizer 2 with Denzel Washington. Now, Kazi has a really interesting history. He started out as an entrepreneur. He was a restaurant owner, and he started that business back when he was in his early 20s, just out of the University of Delaware. And the restaurant business is an extremely difficult business. I mean, if you don't have your numbers right, if you don't have your staffing right, a lot of stuff can go wrong. But it was that early trial that gave Kazi the education that he needed to be able to treat his acting career like a business. That's what you're going to get out of this. You know, what I want you to listen to during this interview is really what Kazi was able to apply from the other disciplines and practices he'd incorporated into his life previously. He'd been a restaurant owner. He'd been a Golden Gloves boxer. And then he decided to go to acting school. Now, for all of you, a lot of you out there, you served in the military, right? And I keep hearing about, you know, guys who think that they don't have enough education, they don't have enough experience, they don't have enough of anything to make it out there in the civilian world. And I keep hearing that employers don't want guys who served in the infantry, they don't want this, they don't want that. Here's the thing. You have what it takes. If you were able to get 4 years in the military, if you were able to get through that and then have an honorable discharge, you have what it takes. You just need to be able to apply what you learned to the rest of your life, right? You need to apply those leadership skills. You need to apply those organizational skills. You need to apply those personal management skills and your own discipline to getting good at something out here. And you can do it. There is no reason why you can't. Before we get into this interview, I just want to give you a couple of announcements. Number one, this podcast is brought to you by F-Bomb Nutrition. You know who they are. I'm talking about them every single episode. And, you know, they make these awesome, delicious packets of fats, right? Macadamia nut butters. So delicious. They mix them up with chocolate. They mix them up with sea salt. They mix them up with pecan butter. And the people who run this company are amazing people. They're sending packages of this stuff overseas to the troops so that they can supplement their MREs with some good nutrition. And all of our listeners get 20% off of their first order when they head over to www.dropanfbomb.com and use the code WarriorSoul at checkout. The other thing is this, and you know, I really want to emphasize this. We do this podcast to help you, right? We do this podcast to give you tools, tactics, ideas, and techniques that you can apply to living your best life, whether you're a veteran or not, right? We focus on the veteran community because that's what we're about. We're about helping out our brothers and sisters. I'll tell you what we're not about. We're not here to entertain you with the same old angry veteran trope. We're not here to help you to justify being pissed off at the world. What we're here is to give you deliverable tools that you can use to improve your life, improve your relationships, improve your career, improve your fitness. That's what we're about. And if you're getting something out of this podcast, we only ask you to do one thing. Leave us a review. This podcast right now only has 11 reviews up on iTunes, right? We need more. We need more. We need to be able to get the word spread about the show. So if you can help us out, it doesn't cost you anything. And I'm 100% certain you're getting value out of these episodes if you're listening to them. So just do us a favor, leave us a review, and let us know what you think of the show. Right? And tell a friend about it. If there's a friend out there you think could be helped by one of our episodes, please, please share it over with them. And that's all the announcements for today. With that, guys, I want to thank you for listening to the Warrior Soul podcast once again. And let's get into this interview with Mr. Kazi Toganas. Kazi, how you doing today, man?
Hey, I'm doing very well, very well. Thanks for having me on the show.
Absolutely. So just for our audience, I was reading up on your story a bit, and prior to becoming an actor, you were a restaurateur for a few years, right?
Yes, yes. I owned a 24-hour diner in Newark, Delaware, right near the University of Delaware campus for almost 5 years.
You know, I'm an entrepreneur, and that's got to be one of the hardest businesses to run in my mind. I mean, as far as making sure that you're pricing everything right, make sure that the food is coming in on time, that none of it goes bad.
Oh yeah, it was an experience. I was incredibly young when I took the place over. I was actually working there while I was in school, the owner just he was exhausted. You know, he was in his 50s and he was just exhausted. He and his wife, they split the shift. So he would work the night, he would do the overnights, and she would do the daytime, you know, as far as from a managing perspective. And he was really, really tired and just really wanted to unload the place. And I just happened to be at the right place in the right time. And I won't say that I got in over my head, but I definitely was open to taking on the experience, because I've always had an entrepreneurial spirit. And I've always kind of wanted to own my own business. And, you know, I did network marketing and stuff like that when I was in college. So I felt I was mentally prepared. But like you said, you know, a restaurant is there's many different angles and facets and tiers of things that can go wrong. You know, anything from, you know, payroll to employees to, you know, electrical to plumbing. Food orders. I mean, it was just a lot to juggle, and it, you know, it was kind of like I learned as I went, but you know, overall, it was such a learning experience. You know,
That's got to be a learning experience for yourself. I mean, doing that at such a young age in your 20s and running a business like that, what kind of lessons did you carry over from that?
Well, you know, you need people to watch your six. Right. I mean, that's really, I mean, I don't really have any other way to put it. I was in trouble, because I couldn't find, good managers. I was going through them like crazy. There was a 6 month period. I must've went through like three or four. And it's because you can't be there 24 hours a day. You can't live there. You can try, but you can't work 24 hours a day. And, you know, I had to let people go for various reasons, falling asleep on the job, you know, giving away free stuff. I had one guy who, on his shift, he would put barbecue sauce on the payphone outside. This is back when we had payphones. Yeah. And then he would call the payphone as people walked by during his shift.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So, So I was like, yeah, well, there's no way to continue off of this, you know. Another guy drinking on the job, right underneath the video camera, which was hilarious, you know, pounding beers like in the back, right underneath the video camera. So I, luckily enough, I was able to ask one of my best friends from where I grew up in Chicago if he would be willing to come out and work for me as a nighttime manager. And, you know, he said yes. And that was such a blessing, because I felt like as soon as he landed in Delaware, you know, I sent him right to work, and, you know, it was trial by fire, and he really watched my back on the night shift. And that really probably saved me from completely crashing and burning, because again, you know, without having people that you can really trust to watch your back, it becomes a really difficult thing, especially being 24 hours.
Wow.
Yeah.
And what made you leave that and decide to get into acting?
Well, as that experience continued to unfold, I always, you know, just to give you a little idea of, you know, my thought process, I've always been interested in film my entire life. Mm-hmm. But, you know, being from like the Midwest, and then, you know, coming to like the University of Delaware, and I got my degree in health and exercise science, I never really thought of that being a feasible career path, like getting into film or acting or the arts. It just never seemed like something that people did. And it was always there. I was always interested. I always watched movies as I grew up. And what happened when I had the diner, I started to realize that, you know, the diner, as much as I loved being, you know, my own boss, it just didn't feel like, it didn't feel right as far as my career path went. I found myself thinking, well, as the previous owner who had, you know, walked away when he was in his mid-50s and said, I'm out, I was thinking, I was like, I don't think I can even last to the, I was like, I don't know how many more years I can do this. Because, I mean, I used to have some crazy stuff happen at nighttime, you know, and I had to be like my own security guard. I'm talking about like physical altercations, yep. You know, all kinds of crazy things. And I just remember sitting out there one day, and someone, like one of my cooks, had like called out and just not shown up. And I ended up having to cook after working the day shift. And I remember sitting out front of the restaurant. It was like it was slow. And I thought, how much longer can I actually do this before, you know, before I burn out? Because this is not easy. And around 2007, a couple of filmmakers, up and coming filmmakers that, you know, resided in Delaware, they wanted to enter the Heinz ketchup commercial contest, and they asked if they could use the diner to shoot. And of course, me always being like a, you know, big supporter of film and loving film, and, you know, I supported like the local film festival. And so I was like, of course, guys, you come shoot. I'll block off one side of the restaurant and you guys can shoot in there. So they get all set up, and then they realize one of their actors is a complete no show, no call, nothing. Mm-hmm. And the director turns to me and he goes, hey, would you be cool to fill in for this guy? And I thought to myself, like, well, I mean, I'm not an actor, but, you know, sure. Okay. And so we shot this whole little, commercial for the contest, and it was a blast. It was fun. Just like, basically I played the boyfriend of a girl who kisses a guy who just ate a burger with a lot of ketchup on it. I just beat him up, you know. It was just like, I throw him in a booth and pound on him. And it was funny. But after we shot it, the director walks up to me and he says, you know, you're really good. You should be an actor. And for whatever reason, that thought wouldn't leave my mind. That idea of me being an actor. And at first I didn't really accept the fact that it was like, well, I'd like to get into film. And I ended up taking a short trip up to New York City, and I saw a banner for the New York Film Academy. And again, it was one of those things. It was one of those overwhelming thoughts that was just like, you need to check that place out. New York Film Academy, check that place out. And I ended up like getting their brochure sent to me. I read through it and I found out there was like an open house coming up, and I went up to the open house. And I would say that moment that really struck me was, I was sitting there listening to them talk about their filmmaking program. And I was like, wow, this sounds heavy. This doesn't sound exactly like what I want to be doing though. And then the head of the acting program said, listen, everyone who's interested in listening about the acting program, stay in this room. And then everyone else kind of separated. They had like people went to hear about the editing program in another room, producing in the other, whatever. So I stayed put to hear about the acting program. Mm-hmm. And the head of the acting program just starts to talk. Like literally he must've been 1 minute into his spiel when Matthew Modine walked into the room.
Nice.
And if your listeners don't know who Matthew Modine is, he was Private Joker from Full Metal Jacket.
Yep, yep.
Which I'm a huge Kubrick fan. So as soon as Modine walks in the room, I was like, I'm like, oh my God, that's Matthew Modine. And he thought we were a class. He didn't realize that we were potential students. So this guy goes up to the front of the room and just starts talking about acting technique. And I'm thinking in my head, I was like, okay, so this school, Matthew Modine just stops by just to talk, like just to see how everything's going. Like I was like, this is crazy. And then, you know, the head of the program said, well, these aren't actual students. These are potential students. These are people that came to the open house. And he said, and I'll never forget it, Matthew Modine goes, wow. He was like, you know, the courage that you would just even come here and hear about this. He was like, I commend you. And then he said, if you do this training, if you go into acting, even if that's not what you're meant to do, even if you don't end up being an actor, this training will make you better at anything that you decide to do. And that just, you know, I think that was probably my moment where the light switch just kind of went off. Wow. And I felt like, okay, my mind was made up. This is where I need to be. This is where I'm going.
What a marketing opportunity for the New York Film Academy. to have Private Joker come up and just talk. I mean, you might have convinced a lot of people out there in the audience as well. I think that's amazing. A lot of things you just said there resonated with me. You know, I started a gym. It's called Metroflex Gym, Long Beach. Back what was it, like 5-6 years ago? That gym's pretty famous now, but back when I started it, didn't have much success, right? And was sitting there, and I have a friend. His name's Tom Platts, and he was a very famous bodybuilder. And he told me the stories about Joe Gold when he owned Gold's Gym, and he was saying that Joe Gold was a bitter, bitter man by the end of his death, right? Because he was always worried about money. He was always worried about the facility. And you talking about, you know, that moment there where you're thinking about yourself getting old with the restaurant, that must have been a thing for you. You know, just thinking about if I don't do something, I'm going to be here and I might end up like that 50-year-old guy who was just so tired.
Yeah. 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 It was pretty... I very definitive moment, as I recall. You know, it's clear, just, you know, sitting out there being like, and it happened, that day actually happened to be on my birthday. It was on my 26th birthday. And I sat out there and I was like, nah, it's not going to go down like this. And then of course, it's funny how things tend to unfold that the way they're meant to. You know, it's like the one door, you're looking for another opportunity. And then this one just kind of really presents itself. And the way the restaurant came to an ending, the way I ended up getting closed, unfortunately, I couldn't really reach a lease agreement with my landlord that made sense for me. Mm-hmm. And it just didn't make sense for me to stay. I just, there was no financial reason for me to stay based on what they were looking for. And, you know, maybe they pushed me to a degree, but I couldn't stay. There was just literally, I would have liked to. But I couldn't. It just was not feasible. So it was just like that closed, but I had already kind of like set up the next step. Like I had, my plan was if things, there's a siren, sorry. That's about okay. That. We'll give it a second, a little tick. New York City all day long.
All day long.
All day long. I my plan was initially to give the restaurant to my parents. If things worked out with the landlord, I was going to let them take it over and let them retire into it. But that ended up not happening. So I had already inquired and actually taken out a loan to go back to the New York Film Academy. I just hadn't decided on a start date. Mm-hmm. And then after we found out that the whole thing wasn't going to work out, the start date ended up being, January 3rd, 2009. And I just stuck with that. And so I was out of, you know, I was out of work for a couple of months after the diner closed November 1st, 2009. And it was kind of a dark period in my life just because, you know, saying goodbye to something that you had worked so hard and invested so much time and money into, it was definitely tough mentally, emotionally. And it's funny, when it rains, it pours. You know, at that time, my grandmother, who I was very close to, died maybe 2 weeks before we closed the diner. And I was just having, just, you know, self-imposed relationship issues. And it was all just, you know, banging on me all at the same time. And you think back to that period and things so seem so bleak and so dark, but the path, you know, that light at the end of the tunnel that people talk about, you know, or that little sliver of hope, oftentimes can actually be the thing that really fulfills you, but you just have to get through that dark period and fight through it. And I know that, it might seem that things are hopeless or whatever, but you know, I feel like those moments that are incredibly difficult for us to get through, and we feel like we're breaking down while it's happening. You feel like it's not going to happen. You feel like, you know, nothing is coming together, that like you feel this sense of like worthlessness, mm-hmm. this sense of zero real belief in yourself. If you can somehow navigate those waters, you know, I navigated those waters through faith, I have to say, for sure. And just the little voice on my shoulder just saying, hey, listen, you got something coming. You have something coming. And listening to that voice and just trying to stay patient. And, you know, I was scared. It was a big step, you know, taking a step into entertainment, coming from zero entertainment type background, no one in the industry, in my family, no relations, nothing like that. Being able to step into that industry was it was scary. You know, that first few weeks I was like, am I even making the right decision? But, you know, once we really started getting into heavy into the classwork at the Film Academy, I started to feel at home. And yeah.
Sometimes it just takes turning the corner, you know, taking a chance. 100%. You got to take chances in life. If you don't take chances, you end up exactly where you were, you know, the place where you don't want to be for a long time. And too many people are out there, they're sitting there and they want to be safe. They don't want to take a risk. And when you don't take risks, you're going to be in the exact same place a year from now as you are now. And that's awesome that you were able to do that.
Yeah. I think that fear of the risk is a risk in itself. You know, that fear of stepping out is actually you taking the real risk, because you're then you're left with the question, could I have, would I have, was it even possible? And I mean, I can't imagine, like, you know, for myself, like if I had just taken a different route and left this stone, you know, unturned, I think I would have probably regretted that decision for the rest of my life.
Yeah, absolutely. So, too many people are just too afraid to start. And sometimes it just takes a little step in the direction to get you going. Like the littlest thing, if you try to do the littlest thing, if you're thinking about writing a book, just write a page each night. You know what I mean? That kind of stuff. If you're thinking about trying to lose weight, start walking a little bit each day, and then maybe add some push-ups and some burpees every day. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But just start regardless of what you're doing. Yeah. You also have a background as a Golden Gloves boxer, right?
Yeah. I it's funny. My athletic background is very, like, very, it spans. When I was younger, my parents, like when I was a kid, like young kid, my parents wanted me to learn how to play all the sports. Mm-hmm. So this was a good decision on their part, I have to say, because it kind of kept me out of trouble, because every time the seasons changed, I would go do something different. So, you know, we did the soccer thing, we did the basketball thing, we did a little bit of football, we, you know, did baseball for a few seasons. And then during the winter, they wanted me to skate. But they were afraid that if I did hockey, that potentially my teeth could get knocked out by a puck. So they were like, we're going to teach you, you just take figure skating. And as I got older, I really started to fall in love with skating. And in hindsight, I realized that it was the performance aspect of skating that I really enjoyed. And at the time, I just kind of you know, maybe around seventh grade, I was like, well, I think this is the only sport I really want to do right now. I just want to, you know, skate. You know, on like not really knowing all the connotations that go along with the sport and how, you know, junior high schoolers, junior high school boys are going to not look fondly upon their figure skating classmate. And, you know, I wasn't exactly a, I wasn't a pushover. So I definitely had to defend myself in ways that, you know, in high school, sometimes if you're getting bullied, there's only one way to handle a bully, yep. You know, and we definitely had those situations that happened. So I never really had, you know, I'd have an issue here or there. But I usually took care of it pretty quickly, to the embarrassment of the other party, being that you get into fisticuffs with a figure skater. But I always, it's funny because I always kind of had this, a little bit of, I really, really wanted to learn to box my entire life. And even while I was competitively skating, like I just was like, man, I'd love to learn, you know, like I would watch old Ali videos and stuff and just be like, oh man, you know, and to me, it was just like watching him was like poetry in motion. And when I got into college, you know, of course I went to University of Delaware, which had a figure, at that time was like one of the best programs in the nation as far as figure skating went. So I was actually skating and going to college at the same time. And then eventually I just got really sick of the politics in the sport and just realized that, you know, it was good for me at one point in time in my life, but as I got older, it was just something that I didn't really want to be associated with anymore. And there was really just a very short time period where from between when I stopped, when I let skating go, and then I walked into Left Jab Boxing Club in West Grove, Pennsylvania. And that just came through a referral of a friend, and I walked in there and met Cliff Johnson. He was the owner of Left Jab. He's still there. And I remember I was in good shape, and you know, I knew I knew some basics for boxing. So he let me get into the ring the first day that I was there, but no headshots, just like body shots. And I remember taking an ass whooping and, you know, went a bunch of rounds, got beat up. And then he walked up and he was like, oh, so you want to join our merry band? And I was like, well, let me think about it. And then, I went back and I remember being sore in all these places, and I was just like, wow, you know, I got a lot to learn. So I want to keep going. And that was it. And I ended up, you know, spending especially while I had the diner, boxing became an invaluable outlet for me. It became my stress release. And, boxing itself was like its own journey. You know, I ended up breaking my nose pretty early. That took a while to get over. And initially I didn't even really have, interest in competing, but Cliff kind of just pushed me into it. He was like, you're good enough, just do it. And you know, that was a whole nother set of adventures, because you know, I was always a fighter. Like for me, it was like if my head game was right, I was gonna do great. But if my head game wasn't right, I was just gonna tank. And it was funny because I have like fights where like I just totally brought the heat and did everything I was supposed to do. And Cliff is jumping up and down in the corner. And then I had some fights where he's just like shaking his head, like, what are you doing? You know, but it all really came down to, you know, head game. And that's, you know, again, it was like, I loved that experience. Boxing definitely opened up more doors for me as an actor than anything else, because having that fight experience is really invaluable. It's just a tool now in my,
it gives
in my
you confidence activity. Too. I mean, like, and that's the thing, you dealt with kids making fun of you and stuff for the figure skating, and you know how much that could wreck somebody. But if you know how to defend yourself, I mean, that stands out to other people. You know what I mean? Yeah. You stand a certain way when you know how to defend yourself. You deal with people in a certain way, not in a violent way, not in a
100%, yeah.
You know, but it's something where, you know, you're confident in yourself. You're confident that you can handle yourself. You know, you've been tested. You know how you'll handle yourself in certain situations. And I think that's invaluable for success when you're dealing with other people, especially when you have to advocate for yourself in certain aspects, like you would as an actor. You know, you need that.
Yeah, it was for the diner especially. I mean, like I said, there were numerous occasions where things got, I don't know. I felt like you know, that late night crowd, man, they'd be like, oh, who's this guy? Let's put him to the test. Let's see.
I've been in a lot of diners late night, and I've seen a lot of crazy shit that happens in diners. A lot of crazy shit. Plates flying, people getting cut, all kinds of crazy things.
Yeah. Yeah. It was weird. I just had a couple of, like, there were a few where, you know, there would be like some things where like something would happen. You try to break up the fight or whatever it would be. But I actually had a couple occasions where people literally just wanted to attack me, just straight up, like beer muscles, ready to fight, want to go. But luckily, because of the boxing, you know, I didn't even get an adrenaline rush. You know, you're just kind of like, okay, like this is not going to work out well for you. You know, you give them the speech, the whole thing, you know, the slow-mo, take your watch off, put it into your back pocket because you don't want the guy, you know, or whatever it's going to be. But like, it was just odd, you know, once people get too much alcohol in their systems, that I feel like some people, that animal or whatever unhappiness within them comes out. And I mean, to like literally get to the point where you're ready to fight somebody that you don't even know. I mean, I've never been there. I've never, that's never happened.
Some people just lose their minds. Some people lose their minds. And beer, alcohol will make you do a lot of crazy shit. It will. I mean, like, I'm convinced that my marriage to my ex-wife was the product of me being too drunk for a period of time. So,
yeah.
Let me ask you this. So you've gotten into acting, you've had a good degree of success. I mean, you're The Equalizer 2, a number of different movies, John Wick, I think, and this project you have, Standing Eight. And I want to get into that in a little bit too, but, you know, so many people come to Hollywood with a dream. I live out here in California. I spent a good amount of time in LA, and I was in the fitness industry. So it was kind of like, you know, Mark Twain said, it's a good idea to be selling picks and shovels in a gold rush. Right. And so I'd watch these people come in and they'd try really, really hard, and then they'd get used up and then they'd leave. And it was like a never ending cycle. Mm. What is it that you did that led you to have this amount of success this early on?
Well, there's been tears, right? Because when you get out of school, they try to kind of help, you know, your teachers try to, you know, kind of guide you to a degree. And, you know, when I was even in school, I pushed really, really hard to get get a lot of agents and managers to come out to our showcase, because we had a thesis project where we wrote an original film. Our class, like, I came up with a story for original film, and the teacher wrote it, and all the actors in my class were assigned different roles in the film. And I pushed really hard. I mean, every day on our lunch break, we would call agents, managers, casting directors, and invite them to come to our showcase. And I think we ended up getting the most that had ever come to any type of event at the Film Academy at that time. I mean, I'm sure they've had some success since then, but we ended up getting 13 to show up. And that's after hundreds of calls. That's hundreds of calls and postcards too. And that was kind of like the first very, very proactive step that I remember taking. Like, A, I came up with a story for our film, but I also was like, listen, if we're going to do this, we need to do this right. We need to use this opportunity. And that was when while I was in school, I still realized how important being proactive as you possibly can be in your field. And
you were being an entrepreneur. You were treating it like a business.
Yes, 100%. Without even really realizing that that's what you're doing. You're just like, what are all the steps that I can take to get to the next level? Or whatever level it, I mean, for me at that point in time, it was just getting my name recognized, getting someone to represent me as an actor, you know, either an agent or manager, whatever. But everyone's, the problem with like, industries, all industries actually is like, you have a goal, right? And you never, you're like, okay, this is the goal. This is where I want to get. This is where I'm headed. You don't always know all the steps to get directly to that goal. So your path ends up not really being like a straight line. You're like veering left, you're veering right, you're veering backwards sometimes, you know, and it's just kind of like this sled, like slow climb in the, you know, up to the top of the mountain, where you're not even taking like a straight path. But I realized very early on that I needed to create my own content, that that was gonna separate me from other people that were in the industry. And I ended up writing a lot. I wrote like a feature film, my first feature, while I was still in school at the Film Academy. It wasn't very good, but I still wrote it. I mean, never saw the light of day, and I've done rewrites, but that was like one thing that I did on the side. I was like going to acting class, and then I set aside during our spring break, I banged out a draft. And I was just constantly thinking of ways, like, how can I propel myself? And when I first got out of school, I just really, you know, I took some casting director classes, but I was so dead broke that I really had to focus on just being able to get on my feet, because after I got out of New York Film Academy, I was so broke, I had to sleep on a couch for 2.5 years and, you know, couldn't afford New York rent at all. Luckily, a friend of mine who I'd known since I was like 18, we went to the University of Delaware and whatnot. He was willing to let me crash on the couch, pay a little bit towards the rent, but that's what basically helped keep me alive. And then I had to take a job catering, and then I took a waiting job, and it just took a little bit of time for me to really, just navigate the point where I could have food on my table, where I could afford to eat like a proper meal a day, because I was really that broke when the diner closed. I literally had nothing left.
I've definitely been there. A lot of our audience has been there, and you know, when you're at that point, you know, it's often a decision of like, okay, am I going to go back to the safe route? You know what I mean? Am I going to go and find something that's secure and just get the money so I can just survive right now? Or am I going to keep going with this dream? Did you have those types of thoughts?
You know what? I made the commitment that once I started acting that I would, that we were doing it for life. I was like, I'm taking this. I was like, either I made, this was my actual commitment. I said, either I will end up on billboards or I will die first.
You burn the ships.
And that was it. I burned the boats. There was no turning back. And I mean, it was difficult at times, you know, sleeping on the couch, your self-image takes a beating. So it's like, after I go through this therapeutic year of acting school, I get out and it's like, all right, to the couch you go, you know, the, you know, God has an interesting way of always keeping you, in check. Right. I guess, so to speak. So, you know, it was just being able to navigate those troubled waters. Some people can't even make it through that. That's the problem. Like, they don't really, they get to that point and they're like, what am I doing? And that's an easy question to start asking yourself if you haven't really fully committed. See, for me, it wasn't a social experiment. For me, it was a career choice. And I knew that it was going to be one of those things that we were going to do or we were going to die. And I was like, I will do. And it took long. It took a while. I ended up hiring, I produced my own short film called Salvation Road, and I put the whole thing on my credit card, and I spent way more money than I needed to, because again, I didn't know a lot of stuff back then and just spent money on things that I shouldn't have spent money on. And, you know, but again, great learning experience. We won a couple awards, you know, I didn't have a lot of money for festival entries. So my festival entries were like, they're only like maybe 10 altogether, but again, great learning experience. Then I went on to produce a feature film with a friend of mine who I'd met through the Film Academy called Terminal Legacy. And that, you know, we scraped money together from everywhere, you know, parents, friends, we did a Kickstarter campaign and put that little feature together. And then in the meantime, I ended up hiring a career coach to kind of guide me. And her name was Gwen Gillis. She's awesome. She really helped a lot. And the thing is that, like, there's constant, it's like constantly reinvesting in yourself, right? Mm-hmm. So there's this idea that you have to, like, if you do make a little bit of money, guess where that money's going to go? It's going to go back into your business. So pretty much all the money that I was making outside of living expenses, I was putting back into myself, because if you want to hire a career coach, right, it's going to cost money to do that. Mm-hmm. If you want to take classes with some casting people, it's going to cost money to do that. So for those years, it's just, and even now, I'm constantly reinvesting back in myself so that you can get to that place of growth where, you know, even if you are investing in yourself, you've reached that breaking point, you know, and you're operating in the black. So those years, those tough years, and then, it took a really long time. I mean, I got out of school in 2009, right? In August, 2009, I ended up getting a manager in 2014, in like October of 2014. It took like 5 years to, my career coach did hook me up with a commercial agent, and that was great. And there were tears to the way that my stuff played out. It was like, I produced my own stuff. Then I ended up booking some industrials for the U.S. Army, the Warrior Quest. Mm-hmm. They would hire actors to do their videos, and they were just training videos, but I ended up doing like three of those. And I remember those were like,
a bunch of people are out there slapping their heads right now and being like, I knew they did that.
So we did that for the Army, and those were great. And then that ended up, because I booked those on my own, I ended up getting a commercial agent, and I ended up booking like a few commercials through her. And then 2014 rolled around, and 2013, I spent a ton of money, and I'm talking about a lot of money. I reinvested all the money that I made into taking classes with casting directors and people that were involved in casting, because I knew that casting directors were the gatekeepers to the industry, the real industry, not like independent industry is its own thing, but like the mainstream industry. And I took a lot of classes that year. In 2013, it was nonstop. And finally, I took a class with Kate Geller from Christie Street Casting. And it just happened that at the same time that I was taking that class with her, she was looking for people for John Wick. And she called me in shortly. I must have maybe like a couple of days after I took the class with her, and had me audition for one of the big roles. And I ended up getting the call back, went in, met the director. And then it was like, there was like, you know, films take a long time before you hear anything, whatever. And I ended up getting cast in a smaller role in the film, but like a week before they wrapped, I ended up getting into the movie, and I ended up booking a Hollywood film without any type of representation, literally just from taking a class at the Actors Green Room. And that was it. And she just really had faith in my work, because she started to bring me in. They ended up casting The Blacklist, that show with James Spader, that following that first season. They were casting that, and she started bringing me in for that all the time. And I ended up booking a couple of episodes of The Blacklist, the first season, 21 and 22. And again, without any type of representation.
Wow.
So, and it was funny, because, you know, you'd think that after you book a film like John Wick, right? And you go, and I met with agents and managers after I booked John Wick. I actually met with an agency the day that I wrapped on John Wick. The day, like that night, I wrapped, and I went straight to this agency meeting. And I said, yeah, I just booked John Wick. The movie with Keanu Reeves. I booked that on my own without a rep. They weren't interested.
Wow.
And you always hear it. They're like, well, you need an agent to book work, but an agent doesn't want to work with you unless you've booked work, right? So it's this kind of like catch 22.
Yep.
And I was thinking in my head, I'm like, how are people not wanting to work with me when I booked a role in a Hollywood film? And then after that, I got a little frustrated, and, you know, I ended up booking those episodes of Blacklist. And one of my buddies just mentioned that he had a manager and he really liked her. So I did a paid for meet and greet to go meet her. And we talked you sit down, you have like 5 minutes to talk to them. I did a little monologue. We chatted a little bit. She offered me a contract the next day.
Oh, and that was, awesome.
Yeah. So it was like, I mean, it's been, you know, think about it, all those different points where it would have been very reasonable for someone to say, I'm out, right? Yeah. Like you produce an indie film that makes no money. You produce a short film, makes no money, right? You produce a feature indie film, makes no money. You're like, wow. So I spent all this money on this film and it's not making any money. It's not doing anything. You know, none of the festivals accepted it for whatever reason, but you don't realize how many things go into that. It's like siren again, how subjective these things are. And, you know, there's like so many different factors, but there were so many different points where I could have just been like, I'm out, I'm out, I'm out.
Yeah, you literally have to be relentless to get where you are. Like you've had to think constantly. You've had to really find other ways. You know, you've adapted, you've overcome. And I think that that's a huge lesson for everybody listening to get out of this. I mean, like, and yes, Katsi's talking about acting, but all of these things apply to business. They apply to career. They apply if you're going for a special forces selection. Anything that you're doing out there, you've got to be relentless and you've got to burn the ships. And because if you have that safety net, and trust me, I've done that where I've tried to have the job and then do the business on the side, you know, you're not committing yourself 100%. And it's only until I got to the point where I was living out of my car where I said, oh, you know what? I better make something happen right now. I think that's huge. Now, I want to ask you about this Standing Eight project, and it's important because I know your mother suffers from lupus, and we have a lot of people in this audience. I suffer from an autoimmune disease myself. It's called ulcerative colitis, and a lot of our audience has also been affected by autoimmune disease of varying sorts, and we've had on Dr. Terry Walls here who's talked a lot about autoimmunity. Tell us about this project you're doing and talk about, you know, what it means to you.
So Standing Eight is a short film, an award-winning short film. We've screened all over the world. We've won numerous awards, accolades. It's about a professional boxer who is forced to retire from boxing after being diagnosed with systemic lupus. And lupus, if your listeners don't know, is an autoimmune disease wherein the body's immune system attacks healthy tissue and organs and can no longer differentiate between good and bad cells. So for my mom, it's affected pretty, I mean, it's hit her everywhere, to be honest, you know. But there's definitely been moments where it's really come after her kidneys really hard. And she's been battling it since before I was born. It took a long time for her to get diagnosed. Doctors didn't know what was going on with her. They weren't, you know, they couldn't pinpoint it, especially back, you know, back in the early 80s and the late 70s. You know, it wasn't, even now there's not any definitive test for lupus. You know, it's like they have to do a series of tests or whatever to kind of pinpoint it. So she's kind of been battling it my whole life. And I've always gotten a certain level of support for everything that I've done from my parents. My father's been incredibly loyal and supportive to my mom. He's been her, her rock, to be honest. And when I was thinking of what project I got in line with a producer, and I teamed up with my buddy, Brian Kazmark, and the producer Louis Peduto, and we were kind of brainstorming what kind of project would we like to do next. And I, at that time, had been overlooked a few different occasions for some pretty big boxing films. And it was frustrating me. And I was just like, well, let's just do something where I play a boxer. And to make the story more personal, we decided to involve lupus. And initially the storyline was kind of like, you know, like my character would have like a daughter or something that got diagnosed with lupus. And then one of my friends mentioned, why don't you just have it as a boxer gets diagnosed with lupus? And I was like, that's great. Let's roll with it. Because again, you know, lupus patients, maybe only 10% of people who are afflicted with lupus are males. So that's an even smaller percentage that's represented. And we just ran with the opportunity, and the story just kind of changed from initially being the boxer trying to hide the fact that he was sick to the point where the boxer is ends up being diagnosed and then forced to retire because the boxing commission won't support his license. So we kickstarted the film, you know, and if your listeners don't know what kickstarting is, it's a crowdfunding platform where you can basically solicit friends, family, strangers, whoever you want for donations to help you fund your project. So we were able to fund the film through two separate Kickstarter campaigns, one for the actual production, pre-production, and the actual production, and then one for post production and for like festival entries and whatnot. And it was a eye-opening experience. I don't think it really, like, there were various points in my life where I realized how sick my mom was. But when you're living with a person who has autoimmune disease, you, and you're younger, you kind of just think that's the way people normally live, right? Mm-hmm. The constant hospital visits, the watching your mom just being able to literally work less and less and less to the point where she can't work at all. Like, you kind of just think that that's the normal way people live. And there was a kind of a turning point for me in college when I wrote a paper on lupus, and I was like, wow. So scientifically, this is what's been going on with my mom. Like, I'm like, wow. And then when we started doing Standing Eight, it's kind of like a love letter to my mom in a way, but I interacting with other people who were suffering from the disease just really opened up my eyes to how devastating it was. And it, my mom has been, she's been fighting it for a long time, but she's been managing it, right? Like, yeah. Actually being able to, you know, she listens to everything her doctor says. She plays that delicate balance between making sure that she's taking all of her like proper vitamins, eating properly, but then also making sure that she's on it with her medications, because she has to set alarms during the day as to when she's supposed to be taking her medications.
Yeah. When you go through something like that, and this is just from my experience and knowing a lot of people who suffer from autoimmunity, when your body's completely rebelling on you, and everything hurts. Everything hurts. Your energy's down. And then the hardest thing to deal with is what you're telling yourself in your brain, because you start to think, well, I've had different thoughts about everything that I've gone through, and luckily I've been able to manage it. But do I ever want to have kids? Do I want them to go on with these genetics? That kind of stuff, and you start to think you're some kind of defect. I really feel for anybody who's going through something like this. And, I was watching some of the clips from Standing Eight, and, the scene where, he's sparring, and then he's got the bruising on his face, and then he's talking about how everything hurts, that really got me. And I think you're doing amazing work there. That's awesome.
Thank you. Thank you. We're going to be, releasing in, we're looking at November, on Amazon, and, I'm going to donate all of the proceeds to the Lupus Foundation. We'll delegate, splitting that between research and raising awareness. And we've been working, we'll be working with the Lupus Foundation to promote the release of the film. And I felt like, as things went along, initially you're just kind of like thinking about doing like a project of that just is, raising awareness, right? But then you realize that this audience has really never had any type of representation, mainstream or otherwise. Mm-hmm. And I've had so many people contact me just from watching the trailer, just saying that they brought them to tears.
Yeah.
So I just realized that I stepped into a realm of something that's a lot bigger than just myself. And I feel like, my mom has always had a difficult time, with the fact that because of autoimmune disease, she hasn't been able to do the things that she always wanted to do. Like, the autoimmune disease, prevented her from having like a stable career and whatnot. She physically just wasn't capable, and that's always bothered her. And I said, well, mom, I was like, well, we are doing something now. I was like, it may be not what you always, when you were younger, that you thought that this was going to be. I was like, but we have the opportunity to help people now. I was like, Standing Eight, I was like, if you weren't who you were, the movie wouldn't even exist, and we wouldn't be giving a voice to this population, millions of people literally who have no content to represent them at all. So I feel like, in a way that we can do some good. And if I can use my art to do a little good in the world, then, at least I can go to sleep at night feeling better about myself, because a lot of people, I feel like that get into positions of I guess you can say power or whatever, or celebrities, because of the voice that they have and because they have a platform, I think sometimes they don't realize how much good they can actually do and how much hope they can actually bring people.
Yeah. It's a blessing to be able to do that. Cassie, I know we've got to wrap up here. You've gone through a lot today as far as, you know, I think there's a lot of tips that people out there can use regardless of what field they're in, whether they're in acting or whether they're in business or whether they're in their own career. Where are you going and what are some things coming up for you?
Well, right now, Equalizer just is finishing up. It's Equalizer 2 is just finishing up its run in the States, and it's opening all over, a bunch more countries, worldwide. So I'm really, really, proud to have been part of that project, to work with such heavy hitters like Antoine Fuqua and Denzel Washington. And, I've got, an episode of The Good Cop coming out on Netflix September 21st. I just wrapped on a really big film for Netflix. Unfortunately, not able to mention anything about it. But that'll be coming out. Great cast. If you look me up, I'm sure you'll be able to find it. Standing Eight will be coming out on Amazon for digital, on Amazon digital via to rent and to purchase. Mm-hmm. And I'm in the process of writing a feature length film that deals with a lot of the same elements as Standing Eight, called Clinch, which I've always felt like if we want to get to a wider audience, we need to get ourselves into theaters and just get a bigger platform for release. So I'm working on a feature length film that deals with, it's not exactly the same story as Standing Eight, but deals with, like I said, a lot of similar ideas, and autoimmune disease, lupus specifically, is a plot device in the film. So that's what I'm producing from like my own perspective. And, I continue to write and audition, and you never know. It's funny, this industry, especially with acting, you never know what'll happen tomorrow. Mm-hmm. It's funny like that. You show up in one audition room and the next thing you know, you're flying out to Boston to act with like Denzel, it's crazy like that. It's crazy.
Oh, that's awesome. That's awesome. Yeah. Some people would love that. You know what I mean? The constant change, the constant excitement, and it's an exciting way to live your life, especially when you're putting all this kind of work into it. Cassie, where can people find you on social media?
I'm big on the gram, on Instagram. You can find me at Kazi Togunas, which is just at KazyTaugunas. And that's my Instagram. That's my go-to. And then I also have, official Kazi Togunas on Facebook, in case there's any people that are still using that platform.
I won't go there. I've been myself, dude, I want to thank you so much for coming on. I want to thank you for everything that you taught us today. And, I wish you the best of luck in your career and blessings to your family and to your mother. I know it takes a lot of strength to go through what she's going through, and, keep her and your family in my prayers.
Well, thank you so much, man. It was a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. And to everybody out there in the audience, I want to thank you for listening today. And, there's a lot in this episode. So we're going to be listing out some of the lessons in the show notes, and that's going to be up at warriorsoul@goji.com. But take a pen and paper and really sit down and listen here. A lot of the stuff he said, like burning the ships and treating your career like a business, that's important. So with that, guys, I want you all to get out there and live your best lives while you can. Take care.